Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this International Women's Day with the ironic possibility that it will not be the press or the Democrats or even the Mueller investigation that will bring down Donald Trump's presidency. But instead, it looks like it might be a porn star, Stephanie Clifford, who goes by the name of Stormy Daniels. An expert on leadership and women's relationship with power, Gloria Felt, the author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power, who was president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, joins us to discuss how Trump, who has bullied and intimidated women into silence and labeled the many women who have come forward charging him with sexual harassment liars, may have met his match with Stormy Daniels. She appears to have broken Trump's NDA, non-disclosure agreement, that came with the $130,000 Trump's lawyer paid Stormy for her silence shortly before the 2016 election. We'll discuss how NDAs have been used by powerful men to silence women who have been sexually abused, but more and more women are coming forward to break these agreements, such has been the case with Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, Harvey Weinstein, and now Donald Trump. Then we'll speak with Catherine Russ, a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisers as senior economist for international trade and finance. She joins us to discuss her article at Econofact, Will Steel Tariffs Put U.S. Jobs at Risk?, and analyze the many reasons why Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum make no sense economically or in terms of national defense. But worst of all, they've taken the focus away from China as the bad actor on trade and intellectual property and instead have turned the U.S. into the bull in the global China shop. Then finally, we'll address the damage Trump is doing to women all around the world following his decision shortly after taking office to impose the global gag rule along with defunding the U.N. Population Fund, impacting family planning programs for the world's most vulnerable populations of 214 million women with unmet needs for modern contraception, where every day 830 women die from preventable pregnancy-related causes. Jamila Taylor, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, joins us to discuss her new report at the Center for American Progress on International Women's Day, Resist Trump's Global Gag Rule. And joining us now is Gloria Felt, who's the author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. She is an expert on leadership and women's relationship with power, a media commentator and a keynote speaker. She was a former teen mom who became a successful CEO and was president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gloria Felt.
Thank you very much, Ian. I'm happy to be here.
So, Gloria, it's an extraordinary irony. Here we are on International Women's Day, and we know how much the press and the Democrats and even the Mueller investigation is looking into Trump, and there's an even talk of impeachment, and there's a great expectation that somehow or other the president of the United States, who's extremely unpopular, will be brought down. But ironically, the person who might bring down Donald Trump is a porn star, Stormy Daniels. How do you see it?
Well, I think the more important thing is that she is a woman, and she is one of only many women who have made allegations about improper behavior about Donald Trump. And I think the real irony, of course, is that you never know in politics. It is an accumulation of things usually, and very often it is not the thing that you expect that will bring someone down. So I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just saying that should it happen, it would be ironic, but not so surprising.
Well, apparently back only just weeks before the 2016 election, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's lawyer, made Stormy Daniels sign this non-disclosure agreement, this NDA. And what's extraordinary about it is that we know, for example, that Harvey Weinstein used these NDAs to buy off women that he had molested and abused. And it seems to be a kind of a tactic or a technique, if you will, for male abusers. Could it be that Stormy Daniels is going to break that tradition, if that's a way to put it?
I think one of the really positive things that's coming out of this is that people are becoming aware of this kind of technique, and it's not been unusual. It's been a standard corporate and political technique. You know, in many situations, it's unclear as to where to exactly put the guilt, but it's not unclear in many of the things that we're seeing now, particularly the things that have come out about Harvey Weinstein and other perpetrators of sexual harassment, abuse, and even rape in some instances. And but what has not been transparent to the public is how often those things got pushed under the rug. Now, do understand that it could happen in part because for, shall we say millennia, it's been just how things are for women, at least in regards to objectification and sort of daily harassment. I mean, and daily, what I call the thousand tiny paper cuts of the combination of implicit bias and sort of innuendos and just assumptions about what women can and can't do, should and shouldn't do. Do we like their voices? Do we like their looks? Do we, you know, this is the kind of stuff that women have endured for many years. And I am of a generation that is old enough to have learned early on, well, you just kind of learn to bob and weave and duck and move away and not let stuff happen. And I think it's fabulous that younger women today are finding their voices. They know they don't have to put up with that stuff. That's how Me Too started. That's how Time's Up started. It's about time. It's way past time.
And again, I'm speaking with Gloria Felt, who's the author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. She is an expert on leadership and women's relationship with power, a media commentator and a keynote speaker. She was a former teen mom who became a successful CEO and was president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Well, I would prefer to be having a conversation about these young women, having a millennial daughter myself, how differently they see the world and how they're sort of post-sexual and post-racial, if you will, and don't have the hang-ups that the older generations have. But just because of the irony of the moment where we're talking about Stormy Daniels having gotten this $130,000 from Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, and the contract she signed was punitive if she were to break in any way and break any confidentiality. For everything she uttered, she'd be charged $1 million. So it was a pretty ironclad thing. And turns out that similar contracts Roger Ailes used to protect himself and, as I mentioned, Harvey Weinstein. So there is, I think, some interesting legal ground being broken here, as well as we pointed out in the beginning, the irony that a lot of people have been investigating Donald Trump and they think he's absolutely ripe for all kinds of indictments, if you will. But somehow he's dodged all these bullets and he's got, what, about 19 women have accused him, and he's basically called them all liars. His own daughter recently basically said she believes her father, and obviously she invoked daughterhood, if you will. So,
well, Ian, the thing is that what the culture is coming to understand, and I want to just say that it is not unusual for the courts and the legal system to follow where the culture has already gone. That's what happened with civil rights. That's what happened with women's rights in the 1960s and 70s. So the courts and the legal system are not always ahead of the culture. Sometimes the culture is ahead, and then the legal decisions follow where the culture is going, because sometimes those who are in the positions of power in the legal system begin to see things differently, and to see that there is another side, and to see that there, in fact, perhaps they have been protecting something that shouldn't have been protected. And what the current climate has made clear to everyone is that sexual abuse and harassment are plain and simple about power. They're plain and simple about misuse of power. They're plain and simple about thinking that you have the privilege to misuse your power over somebody who has less power than you. And remember, our legal system is designed to protect those of us who have less power from those who have more power. So I think it's not, you know, it's not that strange that there could be this kind of shift, even in legal decisions. The law can always find a way. And it's not unusual that the law might follow where the culture is already going. So, you know, ironic as it might be, it's sort of like, it's the ant, the little tiny ant that the elephant is most afraid of. That kind of thing happens in politics too. It's sometimes the little tiny thing that pushes them over the edge and pushes an issue over the edge. And this might just be one of those moments.
Well, I suppose in some ways what happened with Bill Clinton could be described as a tiny ant. At least that's the way that Bill Clinton saw it. But it almost brought him down. This is not unprecedented, but there's nobody more powerful than the President of the United States. And this is a president who...
Well, that's true. But if you think about it, how many presidents of the United States are we well aware had all kinds of peccadilloes, right?
Right.
John Kennedy, Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson. These things were known, but it was a different era.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton should have known that things had changed enough that he couldn't get away with it in the Oval Office. He should have known that. He's a very smart man. So that was like another step forward, but we didn't quite get there.
Right.
I think this might be the moment when we actually get there.
Well, just in closing, it would be a poetic irony, I guess, for people who don't like Trump, and me included, that the destructive political life or the life of Donald Trump that's caused so much destruction could be brought down by his tawdry sex life, and an enormous irony. I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time, Gloria Felt, on this International Women's Day.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Ian. And I would just end this by saying that one of my basic principles is don't do anything you don't want to see on the front page of the New York Times, right?
Anybody in
public life ought to be behaving that way.
Right. Well, anyway.
Okay. All right.
Thanks
you
a
take
lot.
Care.
You too. Bye-bye.
You bet. Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Gloria Felt, who is the author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change How We Think About Power. She's an expert on leadership and women's relationships with power, a media commentator and a keynote speaker. She was a former teen mom who became a successful CEO and was president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Donald Trump has shot the United States in the foot with his new tariffs, which could spark a trade war. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council on Economic Advisers as senior economist for international trade and finance. She is a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research, International Trade and Investment Group, and a research advisor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany. She has been a visiting scholar at the central banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco, and she has a new report at Econofact, Will Steel Tariffs Put U.S. Jobs at Risk? Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Russ.
Thank you, Ian.
And today, of course, Donald Trump made good on his promise to slap 25% tariff on steel and a 10% tariff on aluminum, saying that the U.S. is suffering from unfair trade and that essentially we've been taken advantage of. He actually pointed to Australia as a country that we may be able to do something with. As he said, he praised them for the fact that we have a trade surplus with Australia. So it does seem to me that this is sort of an economic simpleton here. I mean, just because you have a trade deficit with some countries, that's a bad thing. If you have a trade surplus, that's a good thing. Is that how Donald Trump sees the world?
So the message from his Council of Economic Advisors in the Economic Report of the President, Chapter 5, actually presented a more standard view, I guess, of current account deficits or trade deficits that basically is macro conditions that drive these deficits. So if we happen to be recovering faster from the global financial crisis, for instance, then we can expect our trade deficit to grow. And if we're recovering more slowly than other countries, then we could expect it to decline. So his Council of Economic Advisors is right on target with this. The message that you hear coming from, say, Peter Navarro, the director of his National Council on Trade, for instance, some of the statements that his Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, has made, those do seem to have this more tit-for-tat kind of almost mercantilist view where trade deficits are unequivocally a bad thing. It means you're losing. And you definitely see that from some of the statements the president has made as well.
But he also, I mean, first of all, the thing that I find extraordinary about this is that China is supposedly the bad actor on the world stage, particularly with intellectual property, etc. And he railed against China. And then when he had a nice visit both here at Mar-a-Lago with Xi Jinping and then later in China, in fact, he recently said how well he was treated in China. So he seems to have laid off the Chinese. But doesn't this put America in the situation of being the kind of bull in a china shop? I mean, as far as I could tell, most people around the world were concerned about China's trade activities. But now surely the focus has been shifted off China onto the United States, and now the U.S. is the bad guy.
It's true. We've really, with this unilateral set of tariffs, we're really putting a wedge between the United States and then other countries who could be allies with us in trying to combat unfair trade practices or combat production subsidies and other types of non-market behavior in the global economy. So this is shooting ourselves in the foot in a way.
Well, he did go on to attack Germany today. He was talking about how countries don't treat us fairly and went on to say many of the countries that treat us the worst on trade and on military are our allies, singling out Germany. So, again, China gets off the hook and Germany gets punished. Germany has a pretty successful economy. They actually are opening plants here in the United States. Do you know what his beef is with Germany?
Germany does run a very large trade surplus. They also run a fiscal surplus at the same time that they contribute a bit less to defense than they have committed to under a NATO agreement. So I think that's the main... So again, if you think that having a trade deficit with a country is bad and them having a surplus with you is you know, somehow them beating you or being unfair to you, then that would explain this lashing out at Germany. Again, I don't think that there's an economic basis for that point of view, but politically that seems to be the talking point there. With the NATO commitments, I'm not sure if they've made any progress on that this year, but that's kind of an ongoing issue and an issue to be handled between departments and ministries of defense and departments and ministries of state and foreign affairs. It's a more delicate issue with some historical roots. So, but that seems to be one of the one of the baseball bats that we're knocking our allies with right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisors as a senior economist for international trade and finance. She is a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research International Trade and Investment Group and a research advisor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany. And she has been a visiting scholar at the central banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco. And she has a new report at Econofact, Will Steel Tariffs Put U.S. Jobs at Risk? And to answer the question that you posed in your article, Catherine, it's pretty clear from just about every economist who's looked at this is that in order to boost a few jobs in the steel and aluminum sector, and he did, Donald Trump, of course, had some steel workers and aluminum workers on display with him at the photo op in the White House today. For a few thousand jobs, we'd be losing, what, many, many more thousands of jobs. That's the economic reality here, isn't it?
So the sectors where companies use steel as an input and also use inputs made of steel, the jobs in these industries do outnumber the number of steel-producing jobs by about 80 to 1. So that is the case. The Economist today, their March 8th edition, cites a new study by the Trade Partnership where they suggest that possibly as many as 33,000 metal-making jobs might be created under these tariffs, at the same time that 179,000 metal-using jobs our jobs in metal-using industries are destroyed. So those are some numbers according to their model, the first ones I've seen specifically analyzing this particular type of scenario. We also had steel tariffs imposed under the Bush administration. Job losses under those tariffs estimates range from between 24,000 and 200,000 jobs. So not out of line with this estimate you're seeing today by the Trade Partnership. And then estimates for how many might have been saved, the range I've seen is up to 10,000, so still less than the number of jobs that would have been destroyed in the steel-using industries. So there's a real possibility there could be some net job loss. In addition, a lot of the decline in employment we see in the steel producing industries are due to innovation. So the vast majority of the decline in employment is because we can make more steel with fewer people now due to technological advances. There's been some really great academic research on this topic by Jan de Locker that's come out in our premier journal, the American Economic Review. But that means that even if we save jobs now, it's probably just a short-term thing. That over time, the only way that you're going to long-term keep more steel jobs is to tell companies to stop innovating.
Well, it would seem that that might be what's got Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell to go public, and they've been very uncritical of Donald Trump in ways that have mystified a lot of people and wondered why they weren't standing up for, you know, all kinds of reasons, shall we say, why they should have spoken up about many things that have happened so far. But unusually, they both spoke up against Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum. And do you think that has something to do with the statistics that you just told us? In other words, they're afraid that Trump's actions are going to spoil the economy ahead of the 2018 elections.
These are really smart men. I'm sure they're aware of that. But I think what they may also be committed to is a rules-based system. And what's happened by invoking this national security excuse that really doesn't hold up very well in the numbers is the United States, with this move, is starting to undermine the whole principle of a rules-based system governing global commerce. And I think they realize where that could lead. The other thing that might be deterring them are the retaliatory tariffs by our trading partners, in particular Europe, possibly also China. Some of them are targeted directly at Speaker Ryan and Senate Majority Leader McConnell's home district, or home district for Speaker Ryan and home state for Senator McConnell. So it could be the threat of tariffs on Harley-Davidson motorcycles and Wisconsin dairy. It could be the threat of tariffs on Kentucky bourbon that also have caught people's attention.
So when you touched on, as you just did on, Catherine Russ, on the national security aspect, and that is the sort of basis for this ruling, my understanding is that, simply put, the national security dimension here is that if we were at war, for example, unless we have enough steel capacity and aluminum capacity at home, we couldn't, during wartime, ship it by sea because you have to ship heavy steel by sea, and it takes a while. So that you need a domestic capacity in wartime, and that's the sort of framework that they're operating under. And, of course, it made no sense to punish Mexico and Canada because the argument doesn't work. There's no ocean between the U.S. and Canada or the U.S. and Mexico. So is that why he's had to sort of recalibrate? Now, of course, he's taking another bite of the apple in terms of leverage over Canada and Mexico, saying that, you know, we'll let you off the hook over this tariff, steel and aluminum tariffs, but we've got to renegotiate NAFTA.
Yeah, so Secretary of Defense Mattis wrote in a letter that's online for anyone to see to Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross that the defense requirements for steel constitute only 3% of U.S. production. So the national security argument, just by the numbers, is pretty thin. Also, most of the steel that we import is from these allies, as you say. So Canada, Europe, Japan, Mexico, South Korea. So the national security argument is incredibly thin. I think the reason for going the national security route is to avoid an independent review by the independent United States International Trade Commission. So if you're to file petition for some other type of trade safeguard on steel or aluminum, then you would normally have to go through USITC. And because they're an independent agency, they give a much more unbiased review of whether or not protection is warranted or legal under WTO and U.S. trade laws. Whereas this, because it was done under the Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1964, goes through the U.S. Department of Commerce, which the Secretary, of course, is part of the Cabinet. It's not at all an agency that's independent from the White House, although they do have very credible internal, like excellent career staff and analysts who work on different issues. But this particular review could not really, in any sense of the word, be considered independent.
But that didn't stop Donald Trump from saying today that steel and aluminum are the bedrock of our defense industrial base. So he's certainly using the argument, even if it makes no sense, both in terms of what Secretary Mattis is saying and in terms of the whole idea that we don't have, you know, we can't depend upon shipping steel from overseas during wartime.
So the rationale for this move has been shifting over time. I don't know if it's shifting in a particular direction and will land in a particular place or not. Today it sounded like the rationale was to bring steel capacity up to 80%. There's no statement in Secretary Mattis's letter that suggests that a capacity utilization rate of 80% is necessary for national defense purposes. In addition, before that, the rationale was to punish China or to bring to bear some consequences for China's support of its own domestic steel industry. Well, our unilateral tariff will not hurt China. Only 3% at most of our imports are from China. It varies 2 to 3% now. Almost all of those imports from China are already subject to anti-dumping or countervailing duties, so we already have special tariffs on a lot of steel coming from China. So the rationale keeps shifting each time it seems to be rather questionable. So really, it seems to be a case of domestic politics, that it's simpler to say, oh, we're going to put on a tariff, instead of saying, okay, what can we do for these communities that are suffering from shifts in our economy? What can we do to strengthen our social safety net, to strengthen infrastructure, to strengthen educational opportunities, training, apprenticeships, to help give people a better chance in today's economy where technology is advancing so quickly?
Well, since the whole thing makes no sense, and as we've discussed, it looks as though a lot of it has to do with Donald Trump's incredible ignorance about basic economics, where he thinks that if you have a trade surplus with a country, then that's a good thing, like Australia, who import more American goods than they export to the United States. So they're good, but Germany's bad because the opposite is true. That seems to be the way he thinks. But there's also the influence, of course, of Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross and Trade Representative Lighthizer. He's been a lawyer for aluminum and steel companies. And most of all, Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross made his fortune in buying distressed American steel companies and selling them at enormous profits to overseas buyers. So there may be that, maybe a simple dimension there that there are certainly, at least Wilbur Ross might well get a windfall out of this. But what also happened today and seems to have gone under the radar is that a number of countries, including major allies of the United States, Japan, Canada, and Australia, along with Mexico, Vietnam, New Zealand, Chile, Malaysia, Peru, Singapore, and Brunei, signed what is being called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it's as though they're trying to put together the TPP that was one of the first things that Donald Trump eviscerated when he came into power. And, of course, you worked on the TPP during the Obama administration. And it's been widely seen as a massive gift to China, because the whole purpose of the TPP was not just a trade pact, but it was also a way not so much to contain China, but to have the neighborhood organized in such a way that China would be forced to follow the rules of the road rather than make up their own rules, which is what they're doing now. And it also would have had a massive dimension in terms of China's internal governance. The fact that they've been able to turn the clock back away from economic and democratic opening with more freedom and transparency, turn the clock back with Xi making himself dictator for life and cracking down on all democratic openings, etc., would indicate that this, again, is not only tearing up TPP being a gift to China, it has also set back the idea of China moving in a more democratic direction. So it's been a catastrophe. So do you think the deal that was signed today by the vestiges of TPP are going to bring it back? There's even some talk that maybe at some point or other the U.S. will come to its senses and rejoin the TPP.
So I would hardly call it the vestiges of TPP. I mean, this is 11 of 12 members coming together under really uncertain odds and without, you know, the biggest player in the original 12 to make a stand, again, for a rules-based economy. And I agree with you. I think that is us shooting ourselves in the foot, leaving the TPP. It was encouraging to hear statements from Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin over the past week, who apparently has engaged in some high-level discussions of the U.S. possibly engaging in negotiations with these remaining TPP countries, again, possibly re-entering the agreement. The president himself, when he was in Davos, actually said he could entertain the notion, and he said this in a very vague way, not at all a promise, but just a thought that, you know, it needn't be the disaster that perhaps, you know, on the campaign trail, candidates really tend to hate trade, but then once they're governing, they tend to find it much more helpful and convenient to growth. So I find this move by the remaining 11 extremely encouraging and exciting in terms of hope for a rules-based system, for a system based on U.S. values of free and fair trade, trade that could protect consumer privacy, e-commerce, could tackle the non-market behavior of state-owned enterprises, which is one of our biggest beefs with China. So even though China isn't a part of it, those countries in the Asia-Pacific region adopting these standards really throws down the gauntlet there and says, look, this is the standard we think that people should be following. And it makes a statement at a time where China is trying to negotiate its regional comprehensive economic partnership with seven of those same countries and then other countries in the region as well that would lack the teeth. It would lack enforceable labor standards. It would lack enforceable environmental standards. It would lack a number of the values that are really key to American ideas of prosperity and fair commerce. So today's move by those TPP 11 was very exciting, and Japan has made it clear the whole way through that they're keeping it warm for us. If we want to think about joining again, you know, they have left the door open so that it would not be hard to put that deal back together again, or I imagine even tweak and improve it if people felt like that was, you know, necessary. But it's still there for us. And interestingly, Japan has not spurned, but been reluctant to engage with us in a bilateral negotiation, which the administration has been pushing since day one, since Vice President Pence went over and visited Japan early on in the new administration. So I think that they're really showing some leadership over there for rules-based commerce, and what they've done, it should be a hopeful sign to everyone.
Well, I guess just ending on a hopeful note, I guess we can say that Donald Trump won't last forever, so presumably sanity can return at some point. And I thank you very much for joining us, Catherine Russ.
Oh, thank you, Ian. It was an honor.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisors as senior economist for international trade and finance. She is a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research, International Trade and Investment Group, and a research advisor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany. She has been a visiting scholar at the central banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco, and she has a new report at Econofact, Will Steel Tariffs Put U.S. Jobs at Risk? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the damage that Trump is doing to women all around the world following his decision to impose the global gag rule along with defunding the U.N. Population Fund. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jamila Taylor, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where she serves as an expert on domestic and international women's health, reproductive rights, and reproductive justice. And she was a senior policy advisor at IPAS, a global non-governmental organization dedicated to ending preventable deaths and disabilities from unsafe abortions and helping women realize their sexual and reproductive rights. She has a new report at the Center for American Progress on International Women's Day, Resist Trump's Global Gag Rule. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamila Taylor.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us on International Women's Day. And, of course, Donald Trump imposed and expanded the global gag rule almost as soon as he came into office, did he not?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, he did.
And was that done at the behest of the religious right who helped elect him and pretty much put Mike Pence on the ticket?
Well, I will say that, you know, historically we have seen, you know, the global gag rule sort of be used as a political football based on, you know, whoever is running this country. So, you know, if they're pro-choice and support women's rights, then, you know, they are rescinding the policy. Whereas if they are anti-choice and not supporting women's rights, then they're putting it in place. And what we've seen with the Trump administration is that, you know, when we say that the policy was imposed and expanded, what we mean is that, you know, under the global gag rule, it impacts foreign non-governmental organizations that engage in abortion advocacy, meaning, you know, working to change abortion laws in their countries or offering abortion-related information or services from receiving global health funding. And in previous iterations, you know, this restriction was really only targeting organizations doing work in the family planning space. And now we're talking about it impacting all global health funding to the tune of about $9 billion.
But the problem I have with the Mike Pences of this world is that they are also not just against abortion, but they're against any form of family planning that's meaningful and against contraception. And nowadays, we have effective contraceptions, including the morning after pill. So mm-hmm. wouldn't the object be, or the best way to defuse this argument about pro-life versus pro-choice that's infected our politics and paralyzed us in effect for decades, is to simply say, well, okay, let's get rid of abortion by encouraging the proliferation and access to birth control.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right in terms of sort of the polarization around the issue. I will say that, you know, these folks tend to call themselves pro-life, but at the same time, they are, you know, supporting policies that are killing people, you know, policies that not only impact, you know, women's abilities to access life-saving health services, but also their ability to lead, you know, economically secure lives. So, you know, being pro-life, you know, is not genuine, you know, when they say that those are the values that they stand for, in no way, shape, or form do they. And in terms of your point about preventing abortions, you know, abortion, is always going to be something that women need. You know, contraception, all women should have access to effective contraception, but it's not a silver bullet. You know, there are still going to be women, you know, that may be using contraception and it may fail. And so, whereas we do need to ensure access to effective contraception, abortions should also be safe, legal, and available for women to access along with contraception. So the two go together. You know, we want women to have access to comprehensive sexual and reproductive health care, and abortion and contraception are central to that.
But just to buttress your point about these pro-life people actually being messengers of death, or at least encouraging death mm-hmm. around the world, every day 830 women die from preventable pregnancy-related mm-hmm. causes. And globally, mm-hmm. an estimated 214 million women have unmet needs for modern contraception.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Yeah, and I mean, one thing to add too, in terms of the numbers around you know, maternal deaths, you know, there are several you know, situations that women may find them in, you know, that sort of cause maternal deaths, but you know, injuries or complications from an unsafe abortion procedure, that's one of the leading causes of maternal death, and it's entirely preventable. Out of all the things that, you know, could possibly happen, you know, to a woman that could lead to maternal death, you know, injuries from unsafe abortion is the only one that is preventable. And so in the context of this conversation, you know, as you said, you know, we have 214 million women globally that that want access to modern contraception that don't currently have it. And I think we do need to be doing more to make sure that they have access to contraception and also, you know, safe abortion care services too.
And again, I'm speaking with Jamila Taylor, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where she serves as an expert on domestic and international women's health, reproductive rights, and reproductive justice. And she was a senior policy advisor at IPAS, a global non-governmental organization dedicated to ending preventable deaths and disabilities from unsafe abortions and helping women realize their sexual and reproductive rights. She has a new report at the Center for American Progress on International Women's Day, resist Trump's global gag rule. But there's double jeopardy here because on top of doing the global gag rule, President Trump defunded the UN Population Fund, a UN agency working to advance family planning and reproductive health around the world. He said he was going to zero out the family planning budget, but in the fiscal year 2019 budget, he's proposed a 30% cut to the international affairs budget and a 50% cut in international family planning assistance. So are we to assume that Ivanka got to her father and made him be less cruel towards women around the world in desperate situations?
Maybe. But I will say that, it's still a very dire situation in terms of this issue. I mean, funding, is a part of it, but it's not everything. You know, we have cuts in funding, but at the same time, we also have this dreadful policy that is really going to tie the hands of groups that are not only doing, family planning and reproductive health care in, some of the most resource-constrained parts of the world. But the global gag rule is also impacting other development groups. We know that there is a group called WaterAid America or WaterAid International who is providing or supporting access to clean water and hygiene, helping women and children and communities across the world. And so other development aid organizations are also going to be impacted by this. I think another thing to lift up about the global gag rule is that it not only affects the funding that foreign NGOs are receiving from the United States government, but they can't even use their own private non-U.S. funding to do anything related to abortion. So this policy is really going to be tie the hands of providers and also hurt women in the long run. And it's still early. We still don't know the full effects, but we know what other iterations of the global gag rule did and how it impacted women in these situations. And we know that this is going to be bad.
But given that Trump has cut the international family planning assistance budget by 50%,
right.
Isn't it logical, and it just makes me crazy, that I can't seem to understand why this logic doesn't prevail. If you cut the funds for family planning and deny half the women who would normally have gotten it this funding and this access to family planning, won't that result in more abortions?
Absolutely. I mean, even just on a very rudimentary level, when you look at, when women, experience barriers to safe abortion care, whether it be through the policies that may be put into place, or situations in terms of access and location of services, that all it does is cause them to be driven into desperate measures to get unsafe abortions. So that's an issue in and of itself. What the policy is going to do is actually cause more women and more abortions in the long run. And not safe abortions. We know that, of the 42 million abortions or induced abortions that happen globally, about half of them are unsafe. And the majority of those are happening in the developing world. And so we're talking about deaths here. you know, largely, you know, women are also experiencing injuries and complications. The women are also dying. So this policy is killing women.
Well, Jamila Taylor, I'm not sure that you've had an opportunity to confront Mike Pence with this glaring logic or lack of logic in terms of his belief system, but you've surely talked to other so-called right-to-lifers. And what is their defense when you point out the obvious, that if you restrict family planning or make it unavailable, abortion goes up? And if you people are so concerned about abortion, why then are you preventing family planning and contraception?
You know, I have not had the chance to ask my parents this question in particular. What I will say is that what I am encouraged by, you know, in spite of him, you know, sort of having the ability to sort of push his very ugly anti-choice agenda, you know, as vice president of this country, I'm encouraged by the women who are organizing themselves. You know, we saw the Women's March in 2017, and there is still so much vigor, you know, around that effort and like organizing around issues that are important to women. We also are seeing a record number of women running for office, you know, and reaching out to Congress when issues like this arise, you know, or they're voting on these issues. And so what I try to focus on is not Mike Pence, but I'm encouraged by the women who are organizing and speaking up for ourselves, for these issues, for our sisters. And I think because of that strong, their strong voices, that we're going to prevail in all this. And we're going to see some changes over the next couple of years. So I tend to focus on them. And I think on a day like International Women's Day, you know, we should really be, you know, hopeful about the amazing women around the world that are organizing and resisting bad policies that are impacting their lives.
Well, in the House and Senate, we have a Senator Jeanine Shaheen of New Hampshire, and in the House, Representative Nita Lowey of New York. They are the lead congressional sponsors on a bill that would legislatively repeal the global gag rule. It's called the Global Health Empowerment and Rights Act, known as the HER Act. Where does that stand and what chances does it have?
Well, you know, the bill, you know, is, as you said, has been introduced, and it would be a legislative repeal of the global gag rule. The Senate version only has, you know, two Republican co-sponsors. And, you know, I think where we are sort of right now politically, and with, you know, sort of the tone and political environment being, you know, such a, you know, attacking women's health and rights at every turn, I don't think there's an opportunity for the bill to get passed in this congressional session. But I do think that in order for us to see something like this move forward, you know, then we need to see some changes in the composition of Congress. And so it's great that we have this bill. It's out there. It's more of like a messaging bill and a vision for what we'd like to see in terms of doing away with the global gag rule. But unfortunately, we just don't have the votes to see it pass in Congress.
Well, just in closing, Secretary Tillerson is in Africa trying to repair some of the damage done to the continent by Trump's remark calling African countries S-holes. I don't know how. I wouldn't want that job, frankly, but that's what Tillerson is doing there. And so much of the work that you're trying to do here and to undo the damage done, the damage done from the global gag rule and from defunding the UN Population Fund impacts Africa, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely, it does. I mean, another thing that to highlight about the UN Population Fund is the fact that, you know, they are also working in, you know, situations where they're supporting young women and girls who have been victims of rape, you know, in humanitarian settings. So the work that they're doing is really important. And, you know, again, we've sort of talked about some of these other situations where the Trump administration has cut funding for international family planning, and we have the global gag rule in place, and then also the lack of support for UNFPA, you know, it's just, you know, the lack of support across the board. And so we also need to be advocating for just better funding for the broader, you know, development aid budget as well. So I think the S-hole comments, along with the lack of support to countries that need it the most, is just bad for the U.S. position globally. You know, I think, you know, this is going to take more than one trip from Secretary Tillerson to, you know, try to better our relationships with other countries. But we're already in a pretty bad position. So I don't know what can really be done there.
Well, just in closing, what can our audience do on International Women's Day? Obviously, we have the tyranny of the minority. We've got the NRA and the religious right, both of whom are a minority in this country, setting the rules and imposing their belief systems and their religious zeal on the rest of us. So what can our listeners do?
You know, on International Women's Day, I hope that your listeners are encouraged and fired up, you know, and I hope that those listening, you know, they seek out opportunities to engage on issues that are impacting them and the communities around them and speak up, you know, whether it's, you know, calling your representatives and letting them know what issues you care about or engaging in any sort of campaigns or activism around these issues. I think, you know, we're in an interesting political environment, but it's also, I'm also encouraged and motivated by the voices of women that are being lifted up around the world and the work that they're doing to make this world a better place. So I encourage listeners to get engaged and get active on these issues.
Well, Jamila Taylor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jamila Taylor, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where she serves as an expert on domestic and international women's health, reproductive rights, and reproductive justice. And she was a senior policy advisor at IPAS, a global non-governmental organization dedicated to ending preventable deaths and disabilities from unsafe abortions and helping women realize their sexual and reproductive rights. She has a new report at the Center for American Progress on International Women's Day, Resist Trump's Global Gag Rule. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.